Well, good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of the KRFY Morning Show. This is your morning show host, Julie Calamine, and I am so pleased today to be joined by someone a person and a subject that we've never really had on our morning show. Here to introduce Zach Lifton. Zach, you are a PhD and a PG. I'm not sure what that means. You're also hazards geologist at the Idaho Geological Survey in Boise. Hello.
Hi, Julie. How are you?
Oh, great. So happy to have you here. Listeners will know this, that we have you here remotely because you are in Boise, I believe. And of course, we're up here in Sandpoint. That's right.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I have to ask, since I don't know the answer, what is a PG?
PG is just initials we use sometimes. It stands for professional geologist. And it's a certification or a license you can get in most states. And my job here at the survey requires it, and some other work I've done in the past requires it. So it just means I've gone through a process to make sure that I am a professional and licensed to do what I do.
Yes, maybe like engineers or architects have to go through a similar process.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Makes sense. Well, we've got two ways we can go forward. One is to talk about the work and the mission of the Geological Survey. But since we're talking about you, I think I'll just go on that note for a bit longer. Tell us about your education, how long you've been with the State of Idaho Geological Survey, and what got you into the position that you're in now.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'll start at the beginning, I guess. I actually grew up in northern Idaho. I grew up in Moscow, and I just had an interest in science and being outdoors, and that kind of just turned into an interest in geology once I started learning a little about it. And I left Idaho to go to college. I went to college in Ohio. And I originally thought I might be an astronomer, but then I realized that it's a lot of math. And I ended up just continuing to take geology classes, and it just sort of, the path seemed to be pretty clear. So so I majored in geology, and then I came back to Idaho to do a master's degree in Pocatello, and really, got even deeper into the subject, and really enjoyed my time there, and did some other stuff for a few years, and somehow decided that I needed to go back to school again, and so I got a PhD in geology as well.
So wow.
I spent some time kind of in the academic world. But I transitioned, I did some work as a consultant, a private consultant. And then about 8 years ago, I ended up coming to work here for the Idaho Geological Survey. And it's been a really interesting and fun job.
Yeah, well, that's what I'd like to hear about next. Tell us, what is the work of Idaho's Geological Survey? What do you guys do?
Yeah, well, we're a state agency. We're relatively small as far as state agencies go. And we're also, because we're so small, we're administered by the University of Idaho as a special program. So so we don't necessarily get a lot of, a lot of press or attention. But I think we have a pretty important role. We're a non-regulatory agency, but we provide data and interpretations about geologic and mineral data to the state. And so, we have programs in mapping and economic geology, petroleum geology hazards, which is what I work on, groundwater. There's a number of different disciplines of geology that we focus on. And really, it's kind of a public service agency. We just provide data, and that comes in a lot of forms, like maps or sometimes digital data. But that's our mission, and Idaho's a really interesting and geologically diverse place, so there's a lot to cover with that.
Yes, I mean, you've only touched on a couple of them, petroleum and et cetera. So some is for health and safety, I'm sure. Some is for business, as you mentioned. Others, is there an area for just interesting geology too, or not really?
Well, I think all of the sub-disciplines that we cover, encounter just interesting things. It's a really neat state, and so You know, we do, in addition to some of just the data that we publish, you know, sometimes we'll publish like a what we used to call geo notes. They're sort of these little brochure pamphlet publications that maybe cover some interesting topics that are, you know, maybe just more general interest, not necessarily hard science. But there's, you know, in my experience, a lot of people have an interest in geology and the natural world. So those usually are, you know, pretty well received by the public.
Yeah, that's cool. How big is your department?
Well, right now, I think we have about 20 people, full-time staff right now. Moscow is the location of our, what we consider our main office. That's where all the administrative work is done. And we have a smaller Boise office. We have 6 full-time people in Boise and I guess probably about 15 or 16 in Moscow.
Yes, yeah, and all working in the various areas of data collection.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And then we also have some, occasionally we'll have some contract workers, especially in the summertime when folks are out mapping in the field. We'll hire on, you know, contract people for you know, summer terms, essentially, or students.
Yes, okay. Well, it sounds like a lot of people gathering a lot of data that has to be helpful mm-hmm. to the state, whether it's business or safety or interesting points. But let's move on to the geology of Idaho, because it is quite diverse. And mm-hmm. maybe talk a bit about the diversity of our geology here in the state.
Yeah, well, I feel pretty lucky to be able to do geology in Idaho. There's really, I mean, almost any type of geology, most types of rock you can find in Idaho. You know, as far as, you know, age goes, we've got, you know, rocks that are as old as almost 2 billion years old, all the way up to some extremely young rocks that are, you know, 2,000 years old, and everything in between. You know, we've got volcanic rocks, we've got sedimentary rocks, we've got metamorphic rocks, lots of interesting minerals. You know, it's tectonically active. We have a little bit of everything here, and so it makes Idaho pretty unique. And I think, you know, for somebody working on it, or even just, you know, somebody who has just a passing interest in geology, it's a really interesting place to explore.
That's for sure. Well, of course, Idaho is named the Gem State, and I have a little joke. It's kind of a joke. You may find it funnier than some of the listeners, but in relationship to gems, where are we in terms of how wonderful our gems might be? Are we like the dollar store of gems, or do we have some great Tiffany's gems? What's the gem situation here? How do we get the name?
Yeah, you know, I personally don't know a lot about why we were named the Gem State. But we do have, I mentioned we have this publication series called GeoNotes. And there's a GeoNote that was written, you know, years ago by somebody at the survey here talking about why Idaho's the Gem State. And my understanding is that it was maybe more of a political move to try to gain some attention rather than necessarily descriptive. But we do have a lot of interesting gems and minerals here. There's lots of precious metals. You know, we mine gold and silver and, you know, rare earth elements, cobalt, a bunch of things that are really important. And, you know, we do have a number of different gems. And, you know, I'm not a gem expert by any means, but I know actually from my grade school time in Idaho, that Idaho has the Star Garnet, which is our state gem. And it's pretty unique. It's only found in Idaho and India. So, you know, we do, although, you know, the name Gem State might not have come about very honestly, I think we actually do have some pretty good gems to back it up.
And are there rubies in Idaho? Have I got the right state? Can there be rubies here?
Well, I'm gonna just claim ignorance on that. Part of the problem is that there's a lot of gem names that are, you know, not exactly mineral names, and so from a geology point of view, you know, ruby is kind of a generic term in my mind. Like emerald, ruby, those, you know, I'm sure there's like some types of minerals that describes, but you know, I'm not an expert, so I don't want to say, but I think we may have some of those precious stones in Idaho. But again, I'm not the person to ask, so I apologize. Oh. I don't want to mislead anybody and get anybody too excited necessarily.
No, we don't want folks out searching for rubies in Idaho if there are none to be found. But precious metals are very important, and I imagine that's part of your research that you do in the department. And do you have an awareness of what is the most mined precious metal at this time? Is there much going on?
Mining activity, has picked up. It's kind of, you know, it goes on these cycles depending on, the market. Mining is pretty active in Idaho right now. So, there's a gold mine in central Idaho called Stibnite, which I think has been re-permitted to start operating again. And then, you know, there's a number of other mines just all over the state, really, that are active and are, you know, new mines that are being explored in sort of southeast Idaho or central eastern Idaho. There's what's called the Cobalt Belt, and cobalt is a mineral that's really important for a lot of the electronics that we use now. And so there's a pretty sizable cobalt deposit in that part of the state, sort of near Salmon, Idaho. And there's a lot of activity going on over there related to that. So I don't know off the top of my head what, for example, the most abundant precious metal mined in Idaho is, but I would say gold and cobalt kind of float to the top of the list in my head right now.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Electronics has really kind of taken over these areas of mining that we'd never had years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and you know, it's a little outside of our border, but in northern Nevada, there's a pretty large lithium deposit, and which is used in batteries, and so. Yeah, there's a lot of activity, a lot of important minerals in and around Idaho.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I imagine mining techniques have changed so much over the years.
I think so. I mean, it's still a fairly straightforward process. I think a lot of the, there's better techniques for extracting, the minerals from the ore, for example. It's still a physical process. You know, we still have to dig it out of the ground.
So sure. Yes.
I think there's still that sort of fundamental element of it.
Makes sense. Well, listeners, you didn't hear my initial conversation with Zach because you weren't on the phone with us, but the reason that I called him in the first place was to talk more about, basically earthquakes and seismic activity. And the reason being was that I'd been on a trip to California a few months ago and happened to be at a bluegrass festival that whose little town had the claim to fame of being something like a epicenter or something of the San Andreas Fault. They gave tours. They're waiting for everything to explode at some point, which hasn't happened yet, or shake itself to pieces. And the town is like 40 people, but that's their claim to fame. And I thought, well, I know Idaho has, we also have earthquake activity, and we should at least talk about it and learn if we should be safe about any certain things or if it's a mild thing. But this was the main reason I got the idea to get in touch with you. So let's move on to that topic. What's going on with seismic activity in our state?
Well, Idaho is, what we like to say is Idaho is earthquake country. It's seismically active. And sometimes people are surprised by that, you know, whether it's folks that have, you know, moved here more recently or maybe, you know, they just live in a part of the state where they haven't felt a lot of earthquakes over the years. But we do have an active tectonic environment here. And, you know, if you, you know, there's a lot of ways to measure that. But if you just, went by, you know, the number of earthquakes measured in Idaho, compared that to some other states. You know, it changes from year to year, but we're probably in the top 10 states for seismic activity in any given year. You know, Alaska is the first by far. It's really active. California, of course, is too, and so is Hawaii. But Idaho's in the mix there. And, you know, it's sort of thanks to our position and our, you know, tectonic environment. And so, you know, we've had a number of pretty significant earthquakes in Idaho, but they're kind of spread out over time. And so I think, you know, just as a society, we kind of have a short memory for those kinds of things. You know, they're happening and we're working on understanding them and measuring them as best we can.
Sure. Well, can we have do you have a bit of history about earthquakes in Idaho? Have there been anything like anything pretty exciting in the last 100 years or so?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I'll preface it by saying that what we know about earthquakes is pretty limited just all over the world because, you know, we have some historical accounts from really big earthquakes, you know, before we could measure them. But modern seismology has really only existed for, you know, 100 years, maybe a little more than 100 years, where we could actually, you know, measure earthquakes with instruments. And so so that's a pretty small snapshot compared to geologic time. So just keep that in mind. But yeah, you know, we just 5 years ago, we had the second largest earthquake recorded in Idaho near Stanley. And that fortunately didn't really cause any damage and no injuries. But it was a, you know, pretty large earthquake. It's felt, you know, widely across the West. And the most, I guess the largest earthquake, you know, larger than that one, occurred in 1983, near Mackay or Challis, in the Lost River Range. That was the Bora Peak earthquake. That was quite large. And that did kill two children at the time. Hmm. And then even before that, in 1959, there was an even larger earthquake just outside of our border near Yellowstone, but, you know, really close to Idaho, which impacted Idaho and was, you know, shaking was felt all across the state. And then, you know, earlier in the 1900s, there were a number of reported earthquakes, but we didn't really have good ways to measure them. You know, the seismic network at the time was pretty sparse. So we have, you know, newspaper accounts and eyewitness accounts, and we've kind of zeroed in on, you know, rough areas where those earthquakes may have occurred, but we just don't have a lot of good data on those, but quite a few in southern Idaho. And, you know, down into Nevada and Utah as well. But, you know, northern Idaho in Sandpoint doesn't get a lot of big earthquakes, but there have been some, you know, some smaller events up there that have happened in the last, you know, 100 years, for example, that have caught our attention.
Yes. I mean, I remember one 10 or 11 years ago, just when I moved to Idaho, and I think I mentioned this to you, but we were new in our home in Sagal, and it happened, and like little bits of, you know, vibration, and we could see glasses in the cupboard moving just a little tiny bit, and we were quite mm-hmm. confused because we didn't know that about the history of Idaho at the time. So yeah. it didn't really do anything, but we did notice it had happened. Now, I'll go ahead.
And I assume those are the earthquake or the earthquake sequence in 2015. Is that what?
Yes.
The time?
Yes, yeah. That's exactly right. Yeah. I want to back up a bit, though. You said there was a larger earthquake that happened in Yellowstone, and was that the one that created Quake Lake?
Or you exactly. Think, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's quite a story.
Yeah, it's called the Hebgen earthquake. It was, I think, a magnitude 7.3. It's a really large earthquake. And the shaking caused a lot of damage, you know, roads liquefied. But maybe most importantly, it triggered a really, really large landslide. Basically, the whole side of this mountain collapsed. It came down. Sadly, it covered up and buried a campground that had quite a few people in it at the time. And it also dammed up a river. So there's that large mass of material that fell is still there. And that lake, as you mentioned, is still there. It's called Quake Lake. And, you know, there's you know, still dead trees standing in the water from that were growing at the time. And, but, you know, it's an interesting spot to visit. There's some really good interpretive signs. So if folks ever have a chance to drive through there, it's worth a stop.
Yeah, it really is. And a little eerie, too, with the trees sticking out still after all these many years. I was in Alberta last summer fishing on the Old Man River near the town of, well, what was once the town of Frank. I don't know if you'd know about that one, but that was another earthquake that, I think that was earthquake, not landslide. I think it was an earthquake. Mm. Does that one ring a bell or not?
Maybe I know there have been some really large landslides in Canada that have, you know, dammed rivers and caused quite a bit of damage. I don't know that one off the top of my head, but I wouldn't be surprised about it.
No, of course not. Yeah. Well, I have two things. I'm debating which way to go right now, but I'd like to talk a bit more about Yellowstone National Park because it has seismic activity, I think, and volcanic, right? There's a lot going on over there. And those are processes that you would know about and think about. And then if you get on the internet, you'll find that people are worried about major, like, volcanic eruption potentially happening soon there. Tell us about whether that's something we should be thinking about preparing for or how you feel about it.
Yeah, well, that's a question that comes up a lot. You know, that's maybe one of the most asked questions I get is, you know, is Yellowstone going to blow? And, I guess to give a little background, you know, Yellowstone is what we call a hot spot. So there's a lot of heat and magma coming up from the mantle in one area. And our tectonic plates move around, that position of that hotspot changes over time. So it started about 17 million years ago in near the border of Oregon, Idaho, and Nevada. And our plate has kind of moved over it, and now that spot is over under Yellowstone National Park. And along the way, there have been these really big caldera explosive eruptions that have been really catastrophic. They've left a really distinct record in the geologic rocks, in the geologic record around Idaho, and, you know, quite far away. In fact, I think in Nebraska, there's a state park where Yellowstone ash has preserved some really interesting fossils from a much older Yellowstone eruption. And so I think a lot of the worry kind of can be traced back to some, science documentaries. I think maybe it was Discovery Channel or something like that a few years back that, you know, sort of dramatized the eruptions. And a lot of people like to say, well, you know, we have ages on these past eruptions, and, you know, the last two were like 700,000 years apart, and so we're quote unquote due for another one. But I think it's also important to just remember that, you know, these things aren't Swiss watches. You know, there's a lot of complexity. They don't erupt on a schedule. And there's a lot of deviation from event to event. So it's, you know, just because it's exactly 700,000 years or whatever since the last one, it doesn't mean that it's going to erupt again.
Right. Give or take 100,000 years, that would make a big difference, right?
Exactly. Yeah. We may not be around at all when the next one erupts. But that being said, you know, we know it's got a history of these pretty big, devastating eruptions. And so Yellowstone is actually really well studied and really well instrumented. We're still learning a lot about it, but there's lots of seismometers there. There's gas measuring instruments that, you know, monitor gases escaping. People are monitoring temperature. There's all sorts of really precise GPS instruments around the park that are monitoring how the ground surface is changing. It kind of, you know, it'll go up and down in places over time. And so we think that there's a really good chance that we'll have a lot of warning for a really big eruption, because there's going to be a lot of big changes. You know, there's a lot of magma moving around for an eruption like that. And so the idea is that there will be signals and we'll be able to see that coming. So, and there really are no observed evidence at the moment that anything like that is coming. But, you know, there are less catastrophic events that occur more frequently in Yellowstone. So there's the big caldera explosions, which are pretty irregular. They don't happen very often. There are lava eruptions, like lava flows, which happen a little bit more frequently. And then there are much smaller but much more frequent steam explosions. And we've seen evidence of some of these steam explosions in our lifetimes. And so, you know, there's a really nice explanation of this on the USGS Yellowstone Volcano Observatory website, which kind of compares, you know, the small events that happen often all the way up to the big events that are less frequent. And so it's kind of this continuum. But I can't promise anything because I can't see the future, but I don't think that there's anything imminent with Yellowstone. And, you know, we get a lot of questions, you know, whenever there's an earthquake, really anywhere in Idaho, people say, hey, is this going to trigger Yellowstone? But that's just not really how it works, especially for these more distant earthquakes like the one in Stanley. There just really isn't a physical connection to Yellowstone. So that's not really going to affect what's happening in Yellowstone.
Right. Well, so it sounds like they're gathering evidence, gathering data in that area that will hopefully be not only historical data, but predictive data. But in other areas, I know that in some places we're trying to maybe predict when an earthquake would happen. And is that possible? Is there that kind of equipment that lets us know if one is imminent?
Well, currently no. And, you know, I don't want to say never, but, you know, our understanding of earthquakes and the physics and the processes that cause earthquakes is that it's incredibly complex, and there's lots of variables that can, you know, contribute to an earthquake. You know, rock strength and, you know, the condition of the rock, are there fractures, you know, lots of, like, you can just imagine it's a natural system. And so it's not a perfect system that's regular. And so because of that, it makes it really hard to predict. And so far, there hasn't really been any scientifically defended methods for predicting an earthquake. You know, there have been a lot of ideas over the years about, you know, different electromagnetic signals or atmospheric signals that precede earthquakes, but nobody's really ever been able to reproduce that. And so right now, no, I don't see it happening anytime in the near future, but like I said, I don't want to say never.
Right. Someone might come up with an idea that works. Well, are there geographical locations, regions that we would want to be a little more aware of the potential of earthquake than others?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great question, because, you know, short of having predictive abilities, which we don't, you know, the next best thing is to study what has happened. And then, you know, try to, assume that or understand that, you know, maybe if this has happened before in this place, it can happen again. And so part of that is studying the faults that produce earthquakes. And so, you know, part of our job is to identify and map those faults. And if possible, even, you know, dig a trench across a fault and look at maybe the history of earthquakes that have occurred on that fault. And so by doing that, we can start to put together a picture of what is possible or what has happened on a fault. And then that can be used for additional modeling to, you know, like probabilistic modeling to say, well, you know, we think these earthquakes happen about this often. What's the chance that we'll have another one in the next X number of years? And so that's kind of, you know, where we are now. It's not predictive, but it's a way to sort of put some numbers on what is the chance of this thing happening.
Sure. How does one identify a fault line, faults for earthquakes?
Well, in some places are easier than others to identify. So in the desert, where there's not a lot of vegetation, it's great for identifying faults because what happens with at least big faults that are active is that they rupture the surface. And so they leave a big scar on the ground, which we call a scarp. You know, it's basically a step in the landscape. You can imagine if one side of the fault is going up, the other side's going down, you get this sort of stair step. And those can be quite large and quite easy to identify if they're fresh. And then if they're not fresh or if there's a lot of vegetation, sometimes you just have to, you know, get on the ground, look for subtle clues. But most recently, we've got this great tool for doing that. It's called LIDAR. Mm. It stands for light detection and ranging. It's sort of the acronym is sort of taken from radar, which, you know, sort of the same principle. You use a laser and you shoot lots of points of laser light on the ground and you measure the time it takes to reflect those. And so you can essentially create a very detailed map of the ground surface. And the nice thing about that is it can get through vegetation. So you can see the ground surface without all the vegetation cover obscuring what you're looking for. And so with that tool, with that data, we can, we can interpret the landscape and with a little bit of training and experience, you can pick those things out.
Right. Now, LIDAR has been around for a little while, and I'm going to say like 20 years ago in professions where people needed to use it, I think it was quite expensive. Is that still the case?
Yeah, it's not cheap, but it's getting much more available. And you're right, it's been used for about 20 years, and it's really changed, you know, a lot of different fields, including archaeology and geology. It's not cheap because, you know, the instruments are expensive. It's it's typically collected from an airplane, which has to do a lot of flights, back and forth in strips over the ground. Fortunately, you know, the USGS and FEMA have over the last, you know, maybe 5 years have funded a lot of big collections. So Idaho has really benefited from that. I think right now we have about 70% coverage of the state with LIDAR, and in the next couple of years we should have close to 100%. So that's been extremely helpful for the work we do.
That is amazing. And is that information that's available to the general public or just who can get that information?
Yeah, it's absolutely public information. It's publicly funded, so it's available to anybody. There's a little bit of a hurdle, technological hurdle, I guess, for folks that want to, download that raw data and process it. You know, the raw data is big. It's many terabytes.
Oh, right.
You need some sort of specialized software. But the good news is that there's also now a lot of web-based mapping tools that make it a lot easier for folks to just, you know, have that on as the background of their map, and they can kind of just scroll through and use it as a visual aid instead of really getting into the nitty-gritty processing of it.
Sure. What a nice information source for the state. That's just great.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's extremely helpful.
Well, let's circle back to, what would be maybe volcanic activity and also earthquake activity. Is there as we would have for a fire emergency, are there some general guidelines that people might be thinking about if they're concerned that they're within the geographical locations that could be affected by either of those events?
So as far as volcanic activity, I mentioned that Yellowstone, we don't think that there's any sort of big explosive eruption that's imminent. So, assuming that that isn't really a concern, in Idaho, the volcanic hazards are either a lava eruption at a place like Craters of the Moon, which would be kind of like a Hawaiian style, relatively slow flowing lava. Or it could be airborne ash coming from the Cascades. If one of the large Cascade volcanoes erupted like St. Helens did, some of that ash could make its way into Idaho. And that happened during St. Helens in 81. And so, I think with both of those, there would be quite a bit of warning ahead of time. And so I think it wouldn't be something that would, just happen in your backyard and be catastrophic. We would see it coming. Of course, it's still good to be prepared. And I'll kind of have the same advice for earthquakes as well, which is that, we can't really predict earthquakes. We may have a little bit of lead time on volcanic eruptions, but the main point is that, understanding, that there are some hazards is kind of the first step, and then preparing for them, having some sort of plan with your family, whether you're at work or at home, where would you meet up? How would you communicate? And then maybe just having, a simple emergency kit at home in case the power goes out, or natural gas lines are shut off or something like that. Fresh water and maybe some extra medicines if you need them, maybe some food, just some simple things in case you have to wait a week or two for sort of normal society to function again.
Sure. Or if you have to make an exit from your dwelling, then it's good to have those kind of emergency kits ready to go too.
Yep, absolutely.
Which we all hear about, not everybody has done, so it's a good time.
Yeah.
And especially now in fire season, another topic that we won't get into today, but that's a very fast emergency that folks would need to get ready for.
Absolutely. And I would say, if you live in a place where wildfires are a danger, and you have some plan or kit, to prepare for that, I would imagine that a lot of that would be applicable to earthquake hazards or other geologic hazards as well.
For sure. Now, in other parts of the world, when earthquakes happen, houses collapse. And is that something that one might expect here?
It could happen. One advantage that we have here in the U.S. is that we do have some pretty good building codes even in places that don't have earthquake-specific building codes, there's sort of minimum levels of code that have to be adhered to for building homes. And so I think that does protect a lot of us. There's also, one of the big differences between, let's say, homes in Idaho and homes in, let's just say, Turkey, for example, is that a lot of homes, especially, let's say, just Central Asia in general, are masonry. So they're built from stone or brick, and they're not reinforced. And that is really the most dangerous kind of building to be in an earthquake, because masonry stone or bricks, they're not elastic at all. They can't really bend and move if they get shaken. And so they tend to crumble and break and collapse. Whereas our wood frame homes in the U.S., most homes in the U.S. are wood frame, can absorb some of that shaking without breaking. And so that's another key difference that I think makes us a little safer here.
That does seem like a main, very big key difference. That's huge when you think about it. And I would say that I think that the masonry construction here in the U.S. probably is supported, right? Reinforced with steel and other stuff.
Yeah, and certainly anything newer that's masonry would probably be reinforced. There are definitely unreinforced masonry buildings in plenty of places in the U.S. And I think, now that there's this awareness about how they are more dangerous in earthquakes, a lot of places have focused their attention on that, on getting an inventory of how many buildings are unreinforced and then trying to, retrofit those. And, it's a work in progress. There's still places where, that hasn't really been addressed yet, but places like San Francisco and Salt Lake City have really put a lot of energy into trying to address that problem.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, this is another topic, and I'm not sure if this is a geological process or more of a climatological, if that's a word, process. And that is our history of this great Missoula Lake many thousands of years ago that washed through and created geological features. Is that something you could speak to?
Sure, yeah. The Missoula floods were a series of floods. I don't know how many, what the current thinking is, but I think it was potentially dozens of episodes of flooding that swept through North Idaho a little bit and then across Washington. And, for the most part, those floods really scoured away material instead of depositing it. So, there's places like backwater areas of the flooding that probably deposited sediment, but a lot of material is swept away. We've also, in southern Idaho, we have an equivalent. It was the Bonneville flood, and that was believed to just be one single event. I think it was about 15,000 years ago, roughly. And it was caused by the draining of Lake Bonneville, which really covered a lot of Utah and Nevada. I think the simple story is that it filled up and overtopped south of Pocatello and, sort of breached some little saddle there and then eroded out quickly, and then all the water drained out, or a lot of the water. The Great Salt Lake is sort of the remnant of Lake Bonneville, so there's still some of that lake left.
Yeah, major.
That water, sort of rushed across the Snake River Plain in southern Idaho, eventually through Hell's Canyon, and then out through the Columbia River, and we also have lots of deposits and scoured areas in southern Idaho from that. And so they're kind of similar stories in that they're these big catastrophic floods. But, I don't know what to say about that besides them being really interesting and really formative for the state. But, I think, at least as far as, future flood events, I think we have a pretty good handle on, unless a human built structure like a dam collapsed unexpectedly, I think we would probably have a good idea of where that water and where that flooding would come from.
Yes, I would agree with that too.
Yeah.
And was the process for our Missoula floods, the repeated floods up here, was that more of a glaciation? Was that a result of glaciers coming and going? I'm just trying to remember.
Well, my understanding is that there was basically an active glacier that had advanced down and crossed, I think it was the Clark Fork River, and dammed it up. And so, you know, the ice itself was the dam. Huh. And we know that ice floats in water. And so when the water behind the dam, you know, rose high enough, it sort of floated and destroyed the dam and flooded out. But the glacial ice is sort of a continuous, it's like a river of ice. It just moves very slowly. And so that ice continued to flow, blocked the river again, and then the water
repeated.
Yeah, exactly. The water raised up and broke through. And so I think that's why it was so episodic.
Makes sense. Boy, yeah. You'd hate to be a elk or a moose during those times.
Yeah, well, you know, interestingly enough, there were probably humans living in the area at the time. So people probably witnessed it, you know, and I can't imagine how wild that would have been.
Oh, I mean, that would have been a major event. Scary.
Yeah.
But really not something that nothing would happen like that without humans being able to see it coming today.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah.
Right. Well, we've covered a lot of, you know, basically talking about the geology of Idaho. I wanted to ask you if you have any favorite or just geological features or, you know, interesting processes that you focus on when you're not worrying about petroleum.
Oh, well, I focus mostly just on hazards. So
yes.
I let the other smarter folks worry about, you know, minerals and petroleum. But, you know, earthquakes really fascinate me. You know, I also work on landslides, which are really interesting and are certainly an issue in Idaho. But
well, let's just take a minute and talk about landslides. We had one up here between Sandpoint and Bonner's Ferry that closed our main highway it closed it for a short period of time, but it altered it for a longer period of time. It was a big pain.
Yeah. Well, you know, as much as spectacular and sort of catastrophic as big volcanic explosions and earthquakes, landslides happen much more regularly and probably cause more damage and more disruption than either of those, because they're just happening all the time. You know, we have rock fall that gets onto the highway and blocks the road. We've got, you know, if we have a wet spring, for example, it can trigger a lot of landslides. After fires, we typically have debris flows. And because a lot of our roads and railroads and other infrastructure are located in canyons in Idaho, they tend to be susceptible to that. And so, there have been a number of really disruptive landslides. You know, the one you mentioned up near Bonner's Ferry, I don't know if we're talking about the same one, but there have been a number up there that have affected the highways, including, you know, they've had to just reroute the entire highway just north of Bonner's Ferry. That's something that, you know, we do work on. We've worked on inventorying all the landslides that we know about into a big database. And hopefully, you know, folks can use that. Like, for example, the Idaho Transportation Department can use that to focus on sort of priority areas where they know that it's more active. It's a problem. It can get pretty expensive. And you know, there's a lot to learn about it.
Is that research then hopefully somewhat predictive, again, regions or particularly valleys? And then that you've already mentioned that there can be so many ways that the land can slide. You talked about after fires mm-hmm. and rock sliding. And with our diverse geology, there must be a bunch of different types of landslides.
There are, yeah. You know, people have come up with different ways to categorize landslides, which is really useful, you know, from an engineering point of view. But, you know, the bottom line is that, you know, stuff is moving downhill. And, you know, so it could be rocks, it could be soil, it could be, you know, big chunks of earth that move without really breaking apart. You know, we just have a big piece that slides. You know, I wouldn't say that we have really good predictive tools for that, But again, it's sort of a case of if we've had a bunch of landslides in a place, it's a safe assumption that we'll yes. continue to have them there, because there's something about those conditions that are prone to landslides. And, you know, at this point, we kind of know where the areas are that keep giving us trouble. And some of those landslides have instruments installed on them, you know, to record either their GPS position or, you know, a tilt meter, which kind of measures if the ground, you know, changes, if the bottom sure. slides out a little or the top moves a little faster than the bottom, we can measure that. And I don't know if I would call it predictive, but we can see things starting to move, and that can be a trigger for maybe some extra caution in places.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, yeah. Zach, we've covered a lot of geology in the state yeah. of Idaho, and it's been wonderful. We're coming to an end of our time together. Is there any other topic you'd like to address? One thing I will say is that you've made me feel pretty comfortable about not being surprised by a geological catastrophe anytime in the next little bit, which is good.
Yeah. Well, we did cover a lot. I guess I would say that, you know, we really kind of scratched the surface. There's a lot of really interesting things to learn about geology in Idaho. I hope that people maybe take away the idea that, you know, there are hazards in Idaho. We don't necessarily have to be terrified of them, but, you know, being ready, like knowing that they can happen, is sort of the first step. And then, you know, maybe getting a little more information to prepare. And we have some material like that on our website, idahogeology.org. And there's some material. We have a publication called Putting Down Roots in Earthquake Country, which is sort of like a citizen's guide to living in a place with earthquakes. It talks about a lot of the things that we covered, you know, how to prepare, what you can do in your home, for example, to maybe reduce the risk a little. And I think that's, you know, really good information for earthquake specific stuff. But yeah, just more generally, I hope people kind of keep in mind that a little bit of awareness and preparation goes a long way.
Oh, I love that. And if you're just a person who does want to know more about geology of Idaho, is your department, are you a resource for that? Or are there
yeah,
publications?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Idaho Geological Survey has, you know, a ton of publications. We've got maps, we've got reports, we've got pamphlets and, you know, all sorts of stuff. So, you know, I would encourage people to check out our website. It's idahogeology.org.
Okay.
And if you can't find what you're looking for, you can always send us an email and we'll help you find it.
Okay. So idahogeology.org is the place to start. And depending yeah. on your interest, you can go from there.
Absolutely.
Sounds wonderful. I'm kind of interested in star garnets now, and I do know one part of the panhandle yeah. where they're supposedly can be found. Is it true? Like around Clarkia, is that sort of an area?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's called Emerald Creek, which is a fitting name. But yeah, I think that's one of the few places in the world you can potentially find star garnets. So yeah, give it a try. Yeah,
there's a starting place. Well, I think we've covered a lot, and I just want to thank you for taking the time to share your knowledge with us here up in the Panhandle. And I'm just going to conclude by saying thank you so much, Zach Lifton. You are a hazards geologist with the Idaho Geological Survey down in Boise, and I want to thank you for taking the time to share your info.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for inviting me on. It's really a pleasure to talk.